Audible Studios presents Artemis, written by Andy Weir, performed by Rosario Dawson.
Chapter 1. I bounded over the gray, dusty terrain toward the huge dome of Conrad Bubble. Its airlock, ringed with red lights, stood distressingly far away. It's hard to run with 100 kilograms of gear on, even in lunar gravity. But you'd be amazed how fast you can hustle when your life is on the line. Bob ran beside me. His voice came over the radio. Let me connect my tanks to your suit. That'll just get you killed too. The leak's huge, he huffed. I can see the gas escaping your tanks. Thanks for the pep talk. I'm the EVA master here, Bob said. Stop right now and let me cross-connect. Negative. I kept running. There was a pop right before the leak alarm. Metal fatigue. Got to be the valve assembly. If you cross-connect, you'll puncture your line in a jagged edge. I'm willing to take that risk. I'm not willing to let you, I said. Trust me on this, Bob. I know metal. I switched to long, even hops. It felt like slow motion, but it was the best way to move with all that weight. My helmet's heads-up display said the airlock was 52 meters away. I glanced at my arm readouts. My oxygen reserve plummeted while I watched. So I stopped watching. The long strides paid off. I was really hauling ass now. I even left Bob behind, and he's the most skilled EVA master on the moon. That's the trick. Add more forward momentum every time you touch the ground. But that also means each hop is a tricky affair. If you screw up, you'll faceplant and slide along the ground. EVA suits are tough, but it's best not to grind them against regolith. You're going too fast. If you trip, you could crack your faceplate. Better than sucking vacuum, I said. I've got maybe 10 seconds. I'm way behind you, he said. Don't wait for me. I only realized how fast I was going when the triangular plates of Conrad filled my view. They were growing very quickly. Shit! No time to slow down. I made one final leap and added a forward roll. I timed it just right, more out of luck than skill, and hit the wall with my feet. Okay, Bob was right. I had been going way too fast. I hit the ground, scrambled to my feet, and clawed at the hatch crank. My ears popped. Alarms blared in my helmet. The tank was on its last legs. It couldn't counteract the leak anymore. I pushed the hatch open and fell inside. I gasped for breath and my vision blurred. I kicked the hatch closed, reached up to the emergency tank, and yanked out the pin. The top of the tank flew off and air flooded into the compartment. It came out so fast, half of it liquefied into fog particles from the cooling that comes with rapid expansion. I fell to the ground, barely conscious. I panted in my suit and suppressed the urge to puke. That was way the hell more exertion than I'm built for. An oxygen deprivation headache took root. It'd be with me for a few hours, at least. I'd managed to get altitude sickness on the moon. The hiss died to a trickle, then finished.
Bob finally made it to the hatch. I saw him peek in through the small round window.
Status, he radioed.
Conscious, I wheezed.
Can you stand? Or should I call for an assist?
Bob couldn't come in without killing me. I was lying in the airlock with a bad suit. Bet any of the 2,000 people inside the city could open the airlock from the other side and drag me in. No need. I got to my hands and knees. Then to my feet. I steadied myself against the control panel and initiated the cleanse. High-pressure air jets blasted me from all angles. Gray lunar dust swirled in the airlock and got pulled into filtered vents along the wall. After the cleanse, the inner hatch door opened automatically. I stepped into the antechamber, resealed the inner hatch, and plopped down on a bench. Bob cycled through the airlock the normal way. No dramatic emergency tank, which now had to be replaced, by the way. Just the normal pumps and valves method. After his cleanse cycle, he joined me in the antechamber. I wordlessly helped Bob out of his helmet and gloves. You should never make someone desuit themselves. Sure. It's doable, but it's a pain in the ass. There's a tradition to these things. He returned the favor. Well, that sucked, I said as he lifted my helmet off.
You almost died. He stepped out of his suit. You should have listened to my instructions.
I wriggled out of my suit and looked at the back. I pointed to a jagged piece of metal that was once a valve. Blown valve. Just like I said. Metal fatigue. He peered at the valve and nodded.
Okay. You were right to refuse cross-connection. Well done.
But this still shouldn't have happened. Where the hell did you get that suit?
I bought it used.
Why would you buy a used suit? Because I couldn't afford a new one. I barely had enough money for a used one, and you assholes won't let me join the guild until I own a suit.
You should have saved up for a new one.
Bob Lewis is a former U.S. Marine with a no-bullshit attitude. More important, he's the EVA Guild's head trainer. He answers to the guildmaster. But Bob, and Bob alone, determines your suitability to become a member. And if you aren't a member, you aren't allowed to do solo EVAs or lead groups of tourists on the surface. That's how guilds work. Dicks. So, how'd I do? He snorted. Are you kidding me? You failed the exam, Jazz. You super-duper failed. Why? I demanded. I did all the required maneuvers, accomplished all the tasks, and finished the obstacle course in under 7 minutes. And when a near-fatal problem occurred, I kept from endangering my partner and got safely back to town. He opened a locker and stacked his gloves and helmet inside. Your suit is your responsibility. It failed. That means you failed. How can you blame me for that leak? Everything was fine when we headed out. This is a results-oriented profession. The moon's a mean old bitch. She doesn't care why your suit fails. She just kills you when it does. You should have inspected your gear better. He hung the rest of his suit on its custom rack in the locker. Come on, Bob. Jazz, you almost died out there. How can I possibly give you a pass? He closed the locker and started to leave. You can retake the test in 6 months. I blocked his path. That's so ridiculous. Why do I have to put my life on hold because of some arbitrary guild rule? Pay more attention to equipment inspection. He stepped around me and out of the antechamber. And pay full price when you get that leak fixed. I watched him go, then slumped onto the bench. Fuck. I plodded through the maze of aluminum corridors to my home. At least it wasn't a long walk. The whole city is only 0.5 kilometer across. I live in Artemis, the first, and so far only, city on the moon. It's made of 5 huge spheres called bubbles. They're half underground, so Artemis looks exactly like old sci-fi books said a moon city should look. A bunch of domes. You just can't see the parts that are below ground. Armstrong Bubble sits in the middle, surrounded by Aldrin, Conrad, Bean, and Shepard. The bubbles each connect to their neighbors via tunnels. I remember making a model of Artemis as an assignment in elementary school. Pretty simple. Just some balls and sticks. It took 10 minutes. It's pricey to get here and expensive as hell to live here. But a city can't just be rich tourists and eccentric billionaires. It needs working class people too. You don't expect Jay Worth-a-lot Rich Bastard III to clean his own toilet, do you? I'm one of the little people. I live in Conrad down 15, a grungy area 15 floors underground in Conrad Bubble. If my neighborhood were wine, connoisseurs would describe it as shitty, with overtones of failure and poor life decisions. I walked down the row of closely spaced square doors until I got to my own. Mine was a lower bunk, at least, easier to get into and out of. I waved my gizmo across the lock, and the door clicked open. I crawled in and closed it behind me. I lay in the bunk and stared at the ceiling, which was less than a meter from my face. Technically, it's a capsule domicile, but everyone calls them coffins. It's just an enclosed bunk with a door I can lock. There's only one use for a coffin. Sleep. Well, okay, there's another use, which also involves being horizontal, but you get my point. I have a bed and a shelf. That's it. There's a communal bathroom down the hall and public showers a few blocks away. My coffin isn't going to be featured in Better Homes and Moonscapes anytime soon, but it's all I can afford. I checked my gizmo for the time. Crap! No time to brood. The KSC freighter was landing that afternoon and I'd have work to do. To be clear, the sun doesn't define afternoon for us. We only get a noon every 28 Earth days and we can't see it anyway. Each bubble has 2 6-centimeter thick hulls with a meter of crushed rock between them. You could shoot a howitzer at the city and it still wouldn't leak. Sunlight definitely can't get in. So what do we use for time of day? Kenya time. It was afternoon in Nairobi, so it was afternoon in Artemis. I was sweaty and gross from my near-death EVA. There was no time to shower, but I could change at least. I lay flat, stripped off my EVA coolant wear, and pulled on my blue jumpsuit. I fastened a belt, then sat up, cross-legged, and put my hair in a ponytail. Then I grabbed my gizmo and headed out. We don't have streets in Artemis. We have hallways. It costs a lot of money to make real estate on the moon, and they sure as hell aren't going to waste it on roads. You can have an electric cart or scooter if you want, but the hallways are designed for foot traffic. It's only 1/6 Earth's gravity. Walking doesn't take much energy. The shittier the neighborhood, the narrower the halls. Conrad Down's halls are positively claustrophobic. They're just wide enough for two people to pass each other by turning sideways. I wound through the corridors toward the center of Down 15. None of the elevators were nearby, so I bounded up the stairs 3 at a time. Stairwells in the core are just like stairwells on Earth, short little 21-centimeter high steps. It makes the tourists more comfortable. In areas that don't get tourists, stairs are each a half meter high. That's lunar gravity for you. Anyway, I hopped up the tourist stairs until I reached ground level. Walking up 15 floors of stairwell probably sounds horrible, but it's not that big a deal here. I wasn't even winded. Ground level is where all the tunnels connecting to other bubbles come in. Naturally, all the shops, boutiques, and other tourist traps want to be there to take advantage of the foot traffic. In Conrad, that mostly meant restaurants selling gunk to tourists who can't afford real food. A small crowd funneled into the Aldrin connector. It's the only way to get from Conrad to Aldrin, other than going the long way around through Armstrong. So it's a major thoroughfare. I passed by the huge circular plug door on my way in. If the tunnel breached, the escaping air from Conrad would force that door closed. Everyone in Conrad would be saved. If you were in the tunnel at the time, well, it sucks to be you. "Well, if it isn't Jazz Bashara," said a nearby asshole. He acted like we were friends. We weren't friends. "Dale," I said. I kept walking. He hurried to catch up. "Must be a cargo ship coming in. Nothing else gets your lazy ass in uniform." "Hey, remember that time I gave a shit about what you have to say? Oh, wait. My mistake, that never happened. I hear you failed the EVA exam today." He tisked in mock disappointment. "Tough break. I passed on my first try, but we can't all be me, can we?" "Fuck off." "Yeah, I gotta tell you, tourists pay good money to go outside. Hell, I'm headed to the visitor center right now to give some tours. I'll be raking it in. Make sure to hop on the really sharp rocks while you're out there." "Nah," he said. "People who pass the exam know better than to do that." "It was just a lark," I said nonchalantly. "It's not like EVA work is a real job." "Yeah, you're right. Someday I hope to be a delivery girl like you." "Porter," I grumbled. "The term is porter." He smirked in a very punchable way. Thankfully, we'd made it to Aldrin Bubble. I shouldered past him and out of the connector. Aldrin's plug door stood vigil, just as Conrad's did. I hurried ahead and took a sharp right just to get out of Dale's line of sight. Aldrin is the opposite of Conrad in every respect. Conrad's full of plumbers, glass blowers, metal workers, welding shops, repair shops. The list goes on. But Aldrin is truly a resort. It has hotels, casinos, whorehouses, theaters, and even an honest-to-God park with real grass. Wealthy tourists from all over Earth come for 2 weeks' stays. I passed through the arcade. It wasn't the fastest route to where I was going, but I liked the view. New York has Fifth Avenue, London has Bond Street, and Artemis has the arcade. The stores don't bother to list prices. If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
The Ritz-Carlton Artemis occupies an entire block and extends 5 floors up and another 5 down. A single night there costs 12,000 slugs, more than I make in a month as a porter, though I have other sources of income. Despite the cost of a lunar vacation, demand always exceeds supply. Middle-class Earthers can afford it as a once-in-a-lifetime experience with suitable financing. They stay at crappier hotels and crappier bubbles like Conrad, but wealthy folks make annual trips and stay in nice hotels. And my, oh my, do they shop. More than anywhere else, Aldrin is where money enters Artemis. There was nothing in the shopping district I could afford, but someday I'd have enough to belong there. That was my plan, anyway. I took one more long look, then turned away and headed to the port of entry. Aldrin is the closest bubble to the landing zone. Wouldn't want rich people dirtying themselves by traveling through impoverished areas, right? Bring them straight into the pretty part. I strolled through the large archway into the port. The massive airlock complex is the second largest chamber in the city. Only Aldrin Park is larger. The room buzzed with activity. I slid my way between workers who efficiently glided to and fro. In town, you have to walk slowly, or you'll knock over tourists. But the port is for professionals only. We all know the Artemis long step and can get a good head of steam going. At the north side of the port, a few commuters waited near the train airlock. Most were headed to the city reactors and Sanchez aluminum smelter, a kilometer south of town. The smelter uses insane amounts of heat and extremely nasty chemicals, so everyone agrees it should be far away. As for the reactors, well, they're nuclear reactors. We like those far away, too. Dale slithered over to the train platform. He'd be going to the Apollo 11 visitor center. Tourists love it. The half-hour train ride provides stunning views of the moon's terrain, and the visitor center is a great place to look at the landing site without ever leaving pressure. And for those who do want to venture outside to get a better view, Dale and other EVA masters are ready to give them a tour. Just in front of the train airlock, there was a huge Kenyan flag. Beneath it were the words, "You are now boarding Kenya Offshore Platform Artemis." This platform is the property of the Kenya Space Corporation. International maritime laws apply. I stared daggers at Dale. He didn't notice. Damn, I wasted a perfectly good bitchy glare. I checked the landing zone scheduled on my gizmo. No meat ship today. That's what we call passenger ships. They only come about once a week. The next one wouldn't be for 3 days. Thank God. There's nothing more annoying than trust fund boys looking for a moon poon. I headed to the south side where the freight airlock stood ready. It could fit 10,000 cubic meters of cargo through in a single cycle, but bringing it in was a slow process. The pod had arrived hours earlier. EVA masters had brought the entire pod into the airlock and gave it the high-pressure air cleanse. We do everything we can to keep lunar dust from entering the city. Hell, I hadn't even skipped the cleanse after my faulty valve adventure earlier that day. Why go through all that hassle? Because lunar dust is extremely bad to breathe. It's made of teeny tiny rocks, and there's been no weather to smooth them out. Each mote is a spiky, barbed nightmare just waiting to tear up your lungs. You're better off smoking a pack of asbestos cigarettes than breathing that shit. By the time I got to the freight airlock, the giant inner door stood open and the pod was being unloaded. I slid up to Nakoshi, the head longshoreman. He sat at his inspection table and examined the contents of a shipping box. Satisfied that it contained no contraband, he closed the box and stamped it with the Artemis symbol, a capital A with the right side styled to look like a bow and arrow. "Good morning, Mr. Nakoshi," I said cheerfully. He and Dad had been buddies since I was a little girl. He was family to me, like a beloved uncle. "Get in line with the other porters, you little shit." "Okay, maybe more like a distant cousin." "Come on, Mr. N," I wheedled. "I've been waiting on this shipment for weeks. We talked about this. Did you transfer payment? Did you stamp the package?" He maintained eye contact and reached under the table. He pulled out a still-sealed box and slid it toward me. "I don't see a stamp," I said. "Do we have to do things this way every damn time? We used to be so close. What happened?" "You grew up and became an underhanded pain in the ass," he set his gizmo on top of the box. "And you had so much potential. You pissed it away. 3,000 slugs. You mean 2,500, right? Like we agreed?
He shook his head. 3,000. Rudy's been sniffing around. More risk means more pay.
That seems more like a Nakoshi problem than a Jazz problem, I said. We agreed to 2,500.
He said. Maybe I should give it a detailed inspection then. See if there's anything in here that shouldn't be.
I pursed my lips. This wasn't the time to make a stand.
I brought up my Gizmo's banking software and initiated the transfer. The Gizmos did whatever magic shit computers do to identify each other and verify. Nakoshi picked up his Gizmo, checked the confirmation page, and nodded with approval. He stamped the box.
What's in there, anyway?
Porn, mostly. Starring your mom.
He snorted and continued with his inspections.
And that's how to smuggle contraband into Artemis. Pretty simple, really. All it takes is a corrupt official you've known since you were 6 years old. Getting the contraband to Artemis, well, that's another story. More on that later. I could have picked up a bunch more packages to deliver around, but this one was special. I walked over to my cart and hopped in the driver's side. I didn't strictly need a cart. Artemis wasn't set up for vehicles, but it got me around faster, and I could deliver more stuff that way. Since I'm paid per delivery, it was worth the investment. My cart is a pain in the ass to control, but it's good at carrying heavy things. So I decided it was mail. I named him Trigger. I paid a monthly fee to store Trigger at the port. Where else would I keep him? I have less space at home than a typical Earth prisoner. I powered Trigger up. There's no key or anything. Just a button. Why would anyone steal a cart? What would you do with it? Sell it? You'd never get away with it. Artemis is a small town. No one steals shit. Well, okay, there's some shoplifting, but no one takes carts. I motored out of the port. I wound Trigger through the opulent passageways of Shepherd Bubble. It was a far cry from my sleazy neighborhood. The hallways of Shepherd featured wood paneling and tasteful noise absorption carpeting. Chandeliers hang every 20 meters to provide light. Those, at least, aren't stupidly expensive. We've got plenty of silicon on the moon, so glass is locally made. But still, talk about ostentatious. If you think vacationing on the moon is expensive, you don't want to know what it costs to live in Shepherd Bubble. Aldrin is all overpriced resorts and hotels, but Shepherd is where wealthy Artemisians live. I was headed to the estate of one of the richest rich fucks in town, Trond Landvik. He'd made a fortune in the Norwegian telecom industry. His home occupied a big chunk of Shepherd's ground floor, stupidly huge, considering it was just him, his daughter, and a live-in maid. But hey, it was his money. If he wanted to have a big house on the moon, who was I to judge? I just brought him illegal shit as requested. I parked Trigger next to the estate entrance. One of the entrances, anyway, and rang the buzzer. The door slid open to reveal a bulky Russian woman. Irina had been with the Landviks since the dawn of time. She stared at me wordlessly. I stared back. Delivery, I finally said. Irina and I had interacted a zillion times in the past, but she made me state my business every time I came to the door. She snorted, turned, and walked inside. That was my invitation to enter. I made snide faces at her back while she led me through the mansion's foyer. She pointed down the hall and walked in the opposite direction without saying a word. Always a pleasure, Irina, I called after her. Through the archway, I found Trond reclining on a sofa, wearing sweats and a bathrobe. He chatted with an Asian man I'd never seen before. Anyway, the money-making potential is... He saw me entering and flashed a wide smile. Jess! Always good to see you. Trond's guest had an open box next to him. He smiled politely and fumbled it closed. Of course, that just made me curious when I normally wouldn't have given a shit. Good to see you too, I said. I dropped the contraband on the couch. Trond gestured to the guest. This is Jin Chu from Hong Kong. Jin, this is Jess Bashara. She's a local gal. Grew up right here on the moon. Jin bowed his head quickly, then spoke with an American accent. Nice to meet you, Jazz. It caught me off guard, and I guess it showed. Trond laughed. Yeah, Jin here's a product of high-class American private schools. Hong Kong, man. It's a magical place. But not as magical as Artemis, Jin beamed. This is my first visit to the moon.
I'm like a kid in a candy store. I've always been a fan of science fiction. I grew up watching Star Trek. Now I get to live it.
Star Trek? Tron said. Seriously, that's like 100 years old.
Quality is quality, Jin said. Age is irrelevant. No one bitches about Shakespeare fans.
Fair point. But there aren't any hot babes to seduce here. You can't quite be Captain Kirk.
Actually, Jin Shu held up a finger, Kirk only had sex with 3 alien women in the entire classic series, and that number assumes he slept with Elan of Troyes, which was implied but never made clear. So, it might just be 2. Tron bowed in supplication.
I will no longer challenge you on anything Star Trek related. Are you going to the Apollo 11 site while you're here?
Absolutely, Jin said. I hear there are EVA tours. Should I do one, you think? I piped in.
Nah.
There's an exclusion perimeter around the whole site. The viewing hall and the visitor center gets you just as close. Oh, I see. Guess there's no point then. Suck it, Dale.
Anyone want tea or coffee?
Trond offered. Yeah, please, Jin said. Dark coffee if you have it. I slumped into a nearby chair. Black tea for me. Tron vaulted over the back of the couch. Not as exciting as it sounds. Remember the gravity here. He slid to the credenza and picked up a wicker basket.
I just got some high-end Turkish coffee. You'll love it.
He craned his neck toward me.
Jess, you might like it too.
Coffee's just a bad kind of tea, I said. Black tea is the only hot drink worth having.
You Saudis do love your black tea, Tron said.
Yes, technically I'm a citizen of Saudi Arabia. But I haven't been there since I was 6. I picked up a few attitudes and beliefs from Dad, but I wouldn't fit in anywhere on Earth nowadays. I'm an Artemisian. Tron got to work on our drinks.
Talk amongst yourselves. It'll be a minute.
Why not have Arena do it? I don't know. I don't know what the hell she was for, honestly. Jin rested his arm on the mystery box. I hear Artemis is a popular romantic destination. Are there a lot of newlyweds here? Not really, I said. They can't afford it. But we do get older couples trying to spice things up in the bedroom. He looked confused. Gravity, I said. Sex is totally different in 1/6 G. It's great for couples who've been married a long time. They get to rediscover sex together. It's like new.
I never thought of that, Jin said.
Lots of prostitutes in Aldrin if you want to find out more.
No, not my thing at all.
He hadn't expected a woman to recommend hookers. Earthers tend to be uptight on that topic, and I've never understood why. It's a service performed for a payment. What's the big deal? I shrugged. If you change your mind, they run about 2,000 slugs.
I won't.
He laughed nervously and changed the subject. So, why is Artemisian money called slugs? I put my feet up on the coffee table. It's short for soft-landed grams, SLG, slug. One slug gets 1 gram of cargo delivered from Earth to Artemis, courtesy of KSC.
It's technically not a currency, Tron said from the credenza. We're not a country. We can't have a currency. Slugs are purchased service credit from KSC. You pay dollars, euros, yen, whatever. And in exchange, you get a mass allowance for shipment to Artemis. You don't have to use it all at once, so they keep track of your balance.
He carried the tray over to the coffee table. It ended up being a handy unit for trade, so KSC is functioning as a bank. You never get away with that on Earth. But this isn't Earth. Jin reached forward to get his coffee. As he did, I got a look at the box. It was white with stark black text that read, Zapho sample, authorized use only. So this couch I'm on is an Earth import, right? Jin said. How much did it cost to bring here?
That one weighs 43 kilograms, Tron said. So it cost 43,000 slugs to have it shipped.
What does a typical person make, asked Jin, if you don't mind me asking, that is. I grabbed my tea and let the cup's warmth seep into my hands. I make 12,000 a month as a porter. It's a low-paying job. Jin sipped his coffee and made a face. I've seen it before. Earthers hate our coffee. Physics dictates that it tastes like shit. Earth's air is 20% oxygen.
The rest is stuff human bodies don't need, like nitrogen and argon. So Artemis's air is pure oxygen at 20% Earth's air pressure. That gives us the right amount of oxygen while minimizing pressure on the hulls. It's not a new concept. It goes back to the Apollo days. Thing is, the lower the pressure, the lower the boiling point of water. Water boils at 61 degrees Celsius here, so that's as hot as tea or coffee can be. Apparently, it's disgustingly cold to people who aren't used to it. Jin discreetly put the cup back on the table. He wouldn't be picking it up again. "What brings you to Artemis?" I asked. He drummed his fingers on the Zaffo box. "We've been working on a business deal for months. We're finally closing the deal, so I wanted to meet Mr. Lonvik in person." Tron settled into his couch and picked up the box of contraband. "I told you, call me Trond." "Trond it is," Jin said. Tron tore the wrapping off the package and pulled out a dark wooden box. He held it up to the light and looked at it from several angles. I'm not much for aesthetics, but even I could tell it was a thing of beauty. Intricate etchings covered every surface and had a tasteful label written in Spanish. "What have we here?" Jin asked. Tron flashed a shit-eating grin and opened the box. 24 cigars, each in its own paper holder, rested inside. "Dominican cigars. People think Cubans are the best, but they're wrong. It's all about the Dominicans." I smuggled a box of those things in for him every month. Got to love regular customers. He pointed to the door. "Jess, would you mind closing that?" I headed to the doorway. A starkly functional hatch hid behind the finely appointed wall panels. I slid it closed and spun the handle shut. Hatches are pretty common in upscale homes. If the bubble loses pressure, you can seal your house and not die. Some people are paranoid enough to seal their bedrooms at night just in case. Waste of money, if you ask me. There's never been a pressure loss in Artemis's history. "I have a special air filtration system in here," Tron said. "The smoke never gets out of this room." He unwrapped a cigar, bit the end off, and spit it into an ashtray. Then he put the cigar in his mouth and lit it with a gold lighter. He puffed several times and sighed.
"Good stuff.
Good stuff." He held the box out toward Jin, who politely waved it away. Then he offered it to me. "Sure." I grabbed one and slipped it into my breast pocket. "I'll smoke it after lunch." That was a lie. But why would I turn down something like that? I could probably get 100 slugs for it. Jin furrowed his brow. "I'm sorry, but cigars are contraband?"
"Ridiculous, really," said Trond.
"I have a sealed room. My smoke doesn't bother anyone. It's injustice, I tell you."
"Oh, you're so full of shit," I turned to Jin. "It's fire. A fire in Artemis would be a nightmare. It's not like we can go outside. Flammable materials are illegal unless there's a really good reason for them. The last thing we want is a bunch of idiots wandering around with lighters."
"Well, I guess there's that."
Tron fiddled with his lighter. I'd smuggled it in for him years ago. Every few months it needed new butane. More money for me. I took another swig of warm tea and pulled out my gizmo. "Trond?"
"Right, of course."
He pulled out his own gizmo and held it next to mine.
"Still 4,000 slugs?
"Mm-hmm, but fair warning, I have to bump it to 4,500 next time. Things got more expensive for me recently."
"Not a problem," he said.
He typed while I waited. After a moment, my screen popped up the transfer verification. I accepted and the transaction was complete. "All good," I said. I turned to Jin. "Nice to meet you, Mr. Jin. Have fun while you're here."
"Thanks, I will."
"Have a good one, Jess," Tron smiled.
I left the two men behind to do whatever they were up to. I didn't know what it was, but it sure as hell wasn't above board. Tron did all sorts of shady shit. That was why I liked him. If he'd brought a guy all the way to the moon, there was something way more interesting going on than a business deal. I rounded the corner and left through the foyer. Irina gave me a nasty look as I departed. I wrinkled my nose at her. She closed the door behind me without saying goodbye. I was just about to hop into trigger when my gizmo beeped. A porter job had just popped up. I had seniority and proximity, so the system offered it to me first. Pickup location, AG5250. Mass, approximately 100 kilograms. Drop-off location, unspecified. Payment, 452 slugs.
Wow,
452 whole slugs? Roughly a tenth of what I'd just made from a box of cigars. I accepted. I had to make money somehow.
Dear Kelvin Otieno, hi, my name's Jasmine Bashara. People call me Jazz. I'm 9 years old. I live in Artemis. Miss Teller's my teacher. She's a good teacher, even though she took away my gizmo when I played with it during class. She gave us homework to send email to kids at the KSC complex in Kenya. She assigned me your address. Do you speak English? I can speak Arabic, too. What do you speak in Kenya? I like American TV shows, and my favorite food is ginger ice cream, but usually I eat gunk. I want to get a dog, but we can't afford one. I hear poor people can have dogs on Earth. Is it true? Do you have a dog? If you have a dog, please tell me about your dog. Does Kenya have a king? My dad's a welder. What does your dad do?
Dear Jazz Bashara, hello, I am Kelvin, and I am also 9. I live with my mom and dad. I have 3 sisters. They're jerks, and the 2 older ones beat me up. But I'm getting bigger, and someday I'll beat them up. I'm just kidding. Boys should never hit girls. Kenyans speak English and Swahili. We do not have a king. We have a president and a national assembly and a senate. Grown-ups vote for them, and they make the laws. My family doesn't have a dog, but we have 2 cats. One of them just comes around to eat, but the other one is very nice and sleeps on the couch all the time. My dad is a security officer for KSC. He works at Gate 14, and he makes sure only people who are allowed to go in can go in. We live in assigned housing in the complex, and my school is in the complex too. Everyone who works for KSC gets free school for their kids. KSC is very generous, and we are all grateful. My mom stays at home. She takes care of all us kids. She is a good mother. My favorite food is hot dogs. What's gunk? I've never heard of that. I love American TV shows, especially soap operas. They are very exciting, even though my mom doesn't want me watching them. But we have good internet here, so I watch when she's not looking. Please do not tell her. What does your mom do? What do you want to be when you grow up? I want to make rockets. Right now, I make models of rockets. I just finished a model of a KSC-209B. It looks very nice in my room. I want to make real rockets someday. The other kids want to be pilots for the rockets, but I don't want to do that. Are you white? I hear everyone in Artemis is white. There are many white people here at the complex. They come from all over the world to work here.
Dear Kelvin, it's too bad you don't have a dog. I hope you get to make rockets someday. Real ones, not models. Gunk is food for poor people. It's dried algae and flavor extracts. They grow it here in Artemis in vats because food from Earth is expensive. Gunk is gross. Flavor extracts are supposed to make it taste good, but they just make it taste gross in other ways. I have to eat it every day. I hate it. I'm not white. I'm Arabic. Sort of light brown? Only about half the people here are white. My mom lives on Earth somewhere. She left when I was a baby. I don't remember her. Soap operas are lame, but it's okay for you to like lame stuff. We can still be friends. Do you have a yard at your house? Can you go outside anytime you want? I can't go outside until I'm 16 because those are the rules for EVAs. Someday I'll get my EVA license and go outside as much as I want, and no one can tell me no. Building rockets sounds like a neat job. I hope you get that job. I don't want a job. When I grow up, I want to be rich.
Chapter 2. Armstrong sucks. It's a damn shame such an awesome guy got such a shitty part of town named after him. The grinding thrum of industrial equipment oozed from the walls as I guided Trigger along the old corridors. Even though the heavy manufacturing plants were 15 floors away, the sound still carried. I pulled up to the life support center and parked just outside the heavy door. Life support is one of the few places in town that has genuine security protocols.
You don't want just anyone wandering in. The door had a panel you could wave your gizmo over, but of course I wasn't on the approved list. From there, I had to wait. The pickup request was for a package approximately 100 kilograms. No problem for me. I can lift twice that without breaking a sweat. Not many Earth gals can say that. Sure, they have 6 times the gravity to deal with, but that's their problem. Other than mass, the request was vague. No info on what it was or where it was going. I'd have to find that out from the customer. Artemis's life support is unique in the history of space travel. They don't process carbon dioxide back into oxygen. Yes, they have the equipment to do that, and batteries to last months if needed. But they have a much cheaper and virtually infinite supply of oxygen from another source, the aluminum industry. Sanchez Aluminum Smelter outside town produces oxygen from processing ore. That's what smelting is, really. Removing oxygen to get pure metal. Most people don't know it, but there's a ridiculous amount of oxygen on the moon. You just need a shitload of energy to get it. Sanchez produces so much oxygen byproduct that they not only make rocket fuel on the side, they supply the city with all our breathable air and still end up venting the excess outside. So we actually have more oxygen than we know what to do with. Life support regulates the flow, makes sure the incoming supply from the Sanchez pipeline is safe, and separates out the CO2 from used air. They also manage temperature, pressure, and all that other fun stuff. They sell the CO2 to gunk farms, who use it to grow the algae poor people eat. It's always about economics, am I right? Hello, Bashara, came a familiar voice from behind me. Shit. I put on my fakest smile and turned around. Rudy! They didn't tell me the pickup was from you. If I'd known, I wouldn't have come. Okay, I won't lie. Rudy Dubois is a seriously good-looking man. He's 2 meters tall and blonde as a Hitler wet dream. He quit the Royal Canadian Mounted Police 10 years ago to become Artemis's head of security, but he still wears the uniform every day, and it looks good on him. Really good. I don't like the guy, but, you know, if I could do it with no consequences. He's what passes for law in town. Okay, sure. Every society needs laws and someone to enforce them. But Rudy tends to go the extra mile. Don't worry, he said, pulling out his gizmo. I don't have enough evidence to prove you're smuggling. Yet. Smuggling? Me? Golly gee, Mr. Do-Right, you sure get some strange notions. What a pain in my ass. He'd been gunning for me ever since an incident when I was 17. Fortunately, he can't just deport people. Only the administrator of Artemis has that authority. And she won't do it unless Rudy provides something compelling. So we do have some checks and balances, just not many. I looked around. So where's the package? He waved his gizmo over the reader and the fireproof door slid open. Rudy's gizmo was like a magic wand. It could open literally any door in Artemis. Follow me. Rudy and I entered the industrial facility. Technicians operated equipment, while engineers monitored the huge status board along one wall. With the exception of me and Rudy, everyone in the room was Vietnamese. That's kind of how things shake out in Artemis. A few people who know one another emigrate, they set up a service of some kind, then they hire their friends. And, of course, they hire people they know. Tale as old as time, really. The workers ignored us as we wound between machinery and a maze of high-pressure pipes. Mr. Duan watched from his chair in the center of the status wall. He made eye contact with Rudy and nodded slowly. Rudy stopped just behind a man cleaning an air tank. He tapped the man on his shoulder. Pham Binh? Binh turned around and grunted. His weathered face wore a permanent scowl. Mr. Binh, your wife Tam was at Doc Roussel this morning. Yeah, he said. She's clumsy. Rudy turned his gizmo around. The screen showed a woman with bruises on her face. According to the doc, she has a black eye, a hematoma on her cheek, 2 bruised ribs, and a concussion. She's clumsy. Rudy handed me the gizmo and punched Binh squarely in the face. In my delinquent youth, I'd had a few run-ins with Rudy. I can tell you he's a strong son of a bitch. He never punched me or anything, but one time he restrained me with one hand while typing on his gizmo with the other. I was trying really hard to get away, too. His grip was like an iron vice.
I still think about that sometimes late at night. Ben crumpled to the ground. He tried to get to his hands and knees, but couldn't. When you can't get off the ground in the moon's gravity, you are seriously out of it. Rudy knelt down and pulled Ben's head off the ground by the hair. Let's see. Yes, that cheek is swelling up nicely. Now, for the black eye. He rabbit-punched the barely conscious man in the eye, then let his head fall to the ground. Ben, now in a fetal position, moaned. Stop. Rudy stood and took his gizmo back from me. He held it so we could both see. Two bruised ribs, right? The fourth and fifth on the left side. Looks like it, I agreed. He kicked the prone man in the side. Ben tried to cry out, but had no breath to scream with. I'll just assume he has a concussion from one of those head punches, Rudy said. Wouldn't want to take things too far. The other techs had stopped to watch the spectacle. Several of them were smiling. Duan, still in his chair, had the slightest hint of approval on his face. This is how it's going to go, Ben, Rudy said. Whatever happens to her happens to you from now on. Got that? Ben wheezed on the floor. Got that? Rudy asked, louder this time. Ben nodded fervently. Good, he smiled. He turned to me. There's your package, Jazz. Approximately 100 kilograms to be delivered to Doc Roussel. Charge it to the security services account. Got it, I said. That's how justice works around here. We don't have jails or fines. If you commit a serious crime, we exile you to Earth. For everything else, there's Rudy. After that special delivery, I did a few more mundane pickups and drop-offs, mostly items from the port to home addresses. But I did nab a contract to move a bunch of boxes from a residence back to the port. I love helping people move. They usually tip well. That day's move was pretty modest. A young couple relocating back to Earth. The woman was pregnant. You can't gestate a baby in lunar gravity. It leads to birth defects. And you can't raise a baby here anyway. That's terrible for bone and muscle development. When I moved here, I was 6 years old. That was the minimum age for residency back then. Since then, they've bumped it up to 12. Should I be worried? I was just moving on to the next pickup when my gizmo screeched at me. Not the ring of a phone call, not the bleep of a message, but the scream of an alarm. I fumbled it out of my pocket. Fire, CU-12-3270. Lockdown enacted. All nearby volunteer personnel to respond. Shit, I said. I threw trigger into reverse and backed up until I found a patch of hallway wide enough for a U-turn. Now facing the right way, I sped to the ramps. Jazz Bashara responding, I said to my gizmo. Current location, Conrad, up 4. The central safety computer noted my report and popped up a map of Conrad. I was one of many dots on that map, all converging on CU-12-3270. Artemis doesn't have a fire department. We have volunteers. But smoke and fire are so deadly here, the volunteers have to know how to breathe with air tanks. So all EVA masters and EVA trainees are automatically volunteers. Yes, there's an irony there. The fire was on Conrad up 12, 8 floors above me. I screeched along the ramps and up to CU-12, then sped along the corridors toward the third ring. From there, I had to find the lot that was approximately 270 degrees from true north. It didn't take long. A crowd of EVA masters had already converged. A red light flashed over the thick door to the address. The sign above read Queensland Glass Factory. Bob was on scene. As the ranking guild member present, the fire was his responsibility. He gave me a quick nod to acknowledge my presence. Okay, listen up, he said. We've had a full-fledged fire inside the glass factory, which has burned off all the available oxygen in the room. There are 14 people inside. All of them made it to the air shelter in time. There are no injuries, and the shelter is working properly. He stood in front of the door. We can't just wait for the room to cool like we normally would. This factory creates glass by reacting silicon with oxygen, so they have large tanks of compressed oxygen in there. If those tanks burst, the room will contain the explosion, but the people inside will have no chance. And if we let fresh oxygen in, the whole thing will blow. He shoot us away from the doorway to make an empty area. We need a tent right here, sealed to the wall around the doorway. We need an inflatable accordion tunnel inside the tent, and we need 4 rescue workers. The fire brigade, well trained, got on it immediately. They built a cube skeleton out of hollow pipes. Then they taped plastic to the wall around the fireproof door, draped it over the skeleton, and taped the edges together.
They left the rear flap open. They hoisted an accordion tunnel into the tent. This was no small task. Unlike the makeshift tent, inflatable tunnels were made to hold pressure. They're thick and heavy, designed to rescue people from air shelters when there's a complete vacuum outside. A bit of an overkill in this scenario, but it's the equipment we had. The tent wasn't very large, and the tunnel occupied most of the space inside. So Bob pointed to the four smallest responders. Sarah, Jazz, Aaron, and Marcy, get in. The four of us stepped forward. The others put air tanks on our backs, breather masks on our faces, and goggles over our eyes. One by one, we tested our gear and gave a thumbs up. We crowded into the tent. It was a tight fit. Bob stood a metal cylinder just inside. The air shelter is along the west wall. A total of 14 people inside. Copy, 14, said Sarah, a fully licensed EVA master with the most tenure out of the four of us. She was the insertion team's leader. The other fire brigade volunteers taped the tent flap closed, except for one corner, which they left slightly open. Sarah cranked the valve on the cylinder and it sprayed a fog of carbon dioxide into the tent. It's a sloppy process displacing oxygen, but we didn't need to expel every last atom. We just needed to get the percentage as low as possible. After a minute, she cranked the valve shut again, and the people outside sealed that last corner of the tent. She felt the door. Hot, she said. We were about to open a door into a room just waiting to blow up. We weren't going to add oxygen, but it was still unnerving. She keyed the fire unlock code into the door panel. Yes, a code. Once a fireproof room's alarms go off, the doors and vents seal immediately. The people inside can't get out. They have to get into an air shelter or die. Seem harsh? Well, it's not. A fire spreading in town would be far worse than a few people dying in a sealed room. Artemis does not fuck around with fire safety. At Sarah's command, the door clicked open and heat from inside filled our tent. I immediately broke into a sweat. Jesus, said Aaron. The factory was thick with smoke. Some corners glowed red with heat. If there'd been any oxygen to spare, they would have certainly been aflame. Along the far wall, I could just make out the shape of the industrial air shelter. Sarah wasted no time. Jazz, you're with me up front. Aaron and Marcy, stay here and hold the back of the inflatable. I joined Sarah. She grabbed one side of the tunnel's front opening and I grabbed the other. Aaron and Marcy did the same with the back half. Sarah walked forward and I kept pace. The accordion-style tunnel expanded along behind us, with Aaron and Marcy holding the rear steady. Reacting silicon with oxygen creates a lot of heat, hence the fireproof room. Why not just melt sand like they do on Earth? Because we don't have sand on the moon. At least, not enough to be useful. But we do have plenty of silicon and oxygen, which are byproducts of the aluminum industry. So we can make as much glass as we want. We just have to make it the hard way. The primary reaction chamber stood just ahead of us. We'd have to get the tunnel around it to reach the trapped workers. Probably a hot spot, I said. Sarah nodded and led us around in a wide arc. We didn't want to melt a hole in our rescue tunnel. We reached the shelter hatch and I knocked on the small round window. A face appeared, a man with watering eyes and ash-covered face, most likely the foreman, who would have entered the shelter last. He gave me a thumbs up and I returned the gesture. Sarah and I stepped into the tunnel, then clamped the hoop around the shelter's hatch. That was easy, at least. It's exactly what the tunnel was designed for. Still at the tent, Aaron and Marcy pressed their end of the tunnel against the plastic and taped it in place. We'd created an escape route for the workers, but it was full of unbreathable air from the room. Ready to blow it out, Sarah yelled. Sealed and ready, Aaron called back. The folks outside cut a slit in the plastic. Smoke from the tunnel leaked into the hallway, but the brigade already had fans and filters ready to minimize its spread. Tents open! Blow it out! Aaron yelled. Sarah and I exchanged a glance to confirm we were both ready. Together we took a deep breath and popped the vent releases on our air tanks. The escaping gas pushed the smoke along with it, down the tunnel and out into the hallway. Soon the tunnel had breathable air inside. Conrad Up 12 would have a sooty smell for days. We both coughed when we tried the air, but it wasn't too bad. It didn't have to be pleasant, it just had to be non-toxic. Satisfied that it wouldn't kill the workers, Sarah cranked the handle to the air shelter hatch. To their credit, the workers filed out in a fast, controlled line. My respect for Queensland Glass went up a notch. They kept their employees well trained for emergencies. One, two, three, Sarah counted off each person as they passed. I kept my own count to confirm. Once she reached 14, I called out, 14, confirmed! She looked into the shelter. Empty shelter! I did the same. Empty shelter, confirmed! We followed the coughing, choking workers down the tunnel to safety.
Good work, said Bob.
Other volunteers were already fitting oxygen masks on the singed employees.
Jazz, we have 3 moderately wounded, second-degree burns. Give them a ride to Doc Roussel. The rest of you, shove that tent and tunnel into the room and reseal the fire door.
For the second time that day, Trigger and I served as an ambulance.
In the end, the oxygen tanks didn't blow up.
Still, Queensland Glass was destroyed. A shame. They'd always been solid on fire safety. Never even had a single infraction. Bad luck, I guess. Now they'd have to rebuild from scratch. Still, their well-maintained air shelter and regular fire drills had saved a lot of lives. Factories can be rebuilt. People can't. It was a win. That evening, I hit my favorite watering hole, Hartnell's Pub. I sat in my usual seat, second from the end of the bar. The first seat used to be Dale's, but those days were over. Hartnell's was a hole in the wall. No music, no dance floor. Just a bar and a few uneven tables. The only concession to ambiance was noise absorption foam on the walls. Billy knew what his customers valued. Alcohol and silence. The vibe was completely asexual. No one hit on people at Hartnell's. If you were looking to score, you went to a nightclub in Aldrin. Hartnell's was for drinking, and you could get any drink you wanted, as long as it was beer. I loved the place, partially because Billy was a pleasant bartender, but mainly because it was the closest bar to my coffin.
Evening, Loaf, said Billy. There was a fire today. Ed, you went in.
Queensland Glass, I said. I'm short, so I got volunteered. The factory's totaled, but we got everyone out all right.
All right. Well, the first one's on me, then.
He poured a glass of my favorite reconstituted German beer. Tourists say it tastes like shit, but it's the only beer I've ever known, and it works for me. Someday I'll buy an intact German beer to see what I'm missing. He set it in front of me.
Thanks for your service, love.
Hey, I won't say no. I grabbed the free beer and took a swig, nice and cold. Thanks. Billy nodded in acknowledgement and went to the other end of the bar to serve another customer. I brought up a web browser on my gizmo and searched for Zafo. It was a conjugation of the Spanish verb zafar, meaning to release. Somehow I doubted Mr. Jin from Hong Kong brought something with a Spanish name. Besides, Zafo was in all caps, probably an acronym. But for what? Whatever it was, I couldn't find any mention of it online. That meant it was a secret. Now I really wanted to know what it was. Turns out I'm a nosy little shit. But right at that moment, I didn't have anything else to go on, so I mentally set it aside. I had this bad habit of checking my bank account every day, as if compulsively looking at it would make it grow. But the banking software wasn't interested in my dreams. It gave me the dismal news. Account balance, 11,916 slugs. My entire net worth was about 2.5% of my goal of 416,922 slugs. That's what I wanted. That's what I needed. Nothing was more important. If I could just get into the damned EVA guild, I'd pull down serious income from then on. Tours are big money. 8 customers per tour at 1,500 slugs each. That's 12,000 slugs per tour. Well, 10,800 slugs after I paid the guild their 10%. I could only give 2 tours a week, a limitation enforced by the guild. They're cautious about their members' radiation exposure. I'd be making over 85,000 slugs a month, and that's just from tours. I'd also try to get a job as a probe wrangler. They're the EVA masters who bring the probes to the freight airlock and unload them. Then I'd have access to shipments before Nikoshi inspected them. I could sneak contraband in right then or set it aside for later recovery with a sneaky midnight EVA, whatever worked best. Point is, I could cut Nikoshi out entirely. I'd keep living like a pauper until I'd saved up the money I needed. Accounting for living expenses, I could probably get it done in 6 months, maybe 5. As it was, on my porter's salary with smuggling on the side, it would take approximately forever. God damn, I wish I'd passed that fucking test. Once I'd taken care of the 416,922 slugs,